goodbye. Then you come back with a sled, like that's going to make everything okay. You don't even stick around to see me. Why'd you even bother? I sat there for an hour, blaming him for my entire fucked up life. When I rewound everything, running away from my mother, stealing a homeless girl's clothes, fighting with the cops outside the whiskey, overdosing at the Franklin, all that misanthropy and self-destruction came down to the same thing. A massive chip I had been carrying on my shoulder my whole life because my father had abandoned me. Not only had he left me at 3, but he had pushed me away when I reached out to him for help 16 years later. When I returned home, we were on the verge of leaving for the Generation Swine Tour. I decided to exercise my feelings for my father once and for all on stage. I composed a bass piece with Chris Vrenna of Nine Inch Nails, in which I soloed over all these different textures and soundscapes while a series of slides flashed in the background. The images were of an embryo, a child being born, a cute baby photo of myself, and a picture of me when I was a happy little kid in a Halloween mask. Then the music darkened, and a series of words flashed across 2 40-inch wide screens. Abandonment, vacant, heroin, destruction. Then the music stopped, and a big question mark appeared, as if to say, why me, or what next? To close the piece, I played dark ambient noise and short minor key melodies on the bass, as the film Donna and I had made at my father's graveside played in the background. The first night I performed the solo, my eyes brimmed with tears. Afterward, fans backstage said that they had cried too because they had also been abandoned by their fathers. Of course, other people came up and just said I was a freak and should deal with my issues. But that was my way of dealing with them. It was through Randy that I found out about my full sister, Lisa. My mother had always told me that Lisa had left home and did not want anyone in the family to find or visit her, so I hadn't thought much about her. Randy couldn't believe it when I told him. Lisa wasn't even capable of making a decision like that. She had Down syndrome and had been living in a home somewhere, he wasn't sure where exactly, for over 30 years. She was blind, mute, and unable to walk, put on her clothes, or feed herself. As I ran around the world worrying about my band and what drugs I could put in my system, she had been sitting all that time in a wheelchair in some rest home for invalids. I swore to track her down when the Generation Swine Tour ended and do everything in my power to make sure she had the best care money could buy. I couldn't understand why my mother never bothered to tell the truth. My whole life I'd been blowing around the world like a sapling without roots. My parents were lost to me, and as for my children, every day I was fighting to keep them as Brandy vilified me in court, which wasn't a difficult feat considering my past. Now, 3 decades too late, I finally learned that there were others out there like me. 8 years of sobriety, 6 years of marriage, and the responsibility required to raise 3 children had cleared my head for the first time. And as I looked around, I had a revelation. My life sucked. I became angrier than ever, and I wanted to start getting high again, but we had a rule on the tour that each time someone was caught drunk or high, he had to pay $25,000. We wanted to be at the top of our game live, not vomiting and passing out on the side of the stage. To make sure no one cheated, we had a guy on the road administering random urine tests. Vince, of course, was busted within the first 2 weeks. The Sober Swine Tour was supposed to be our big reunion. The world was supposed to rise up and chant Motley Crue just because Vince was back. But the truth was that we still weren't Motley Crue. Sure, all the members were there, but the tour was a mess, with click tracks and backing tapes and racks of effects attempting to imitate the studio experimentation of the album. We were more a computer than a band on stage. When we played Livewire, I felt a rush of excitement because the song was organic. When we played Find Myself, it felt as cold as karaoke. Though Vince was back in the band singing, I could tell he wasn't happy. Part of the problem was that, as Kovac had predicted, Elektra was shafting us on publicity, promotion, and marketing. And with our morale as low as it was, Tommy wanting to modernize, Mick still pissed because we had lost faith in him, Vince in financial hell, and all my family problems, It wasn't going to be very hard for Electra to lay on the extra straw to break Motley's back. And we couldn't let that happen, because if we broke up, we'd owe them $12 million. If we stayed together, they'd owe us $12 million. Electra soon stopped paying us, hoping to drive us further into debt and desperation. They tried to get to us through our wives and lawyers, planting insecurities about the band's future. They even tried to get at us through Pamela's manager, telling her that Tommy was the star of Motley Crue and would be better off on his own. They came at us from every angle. So we went to war. As far as we were concerned, the Generation Swine Tour was not just an attempt to promote an album and a band, but a way to get the label to pay attention to us, to give us our money and release us from our contract so we could be free to do what we wanted. So, from the stage, I had the audience chant, "Fuck Electra." I arranged for an interview in Spin magazine for the sole reason of having the opportunity to call Sylvia Rhone a cunt in print. I was determined to be the most painful thorn in her side. After all, this was a label that made all its money from rock and roll, from us, from Metallica, from AC/DC, but had now disavowed it. A label so stupid that as they were squeezing us, they were also dropping an English group called The Prodigy because they thought the band had no future. Less than a year later, The Prodigy signed a multi-million dollar deal with Maverick Records and became the first techno band to ever have a number one record in America. My plan was to make Electra so sick of us that they'd do anything to let us go. Now, I realize that probably wasn't the best tactic. I committed the mistake of making it personal with Sylvia, so that she felt she was being abused and taken advantage of. And that led her to think that I was mean and deserved everything I got, so she tightened the screws on us further, without a thought for the fact that we had children and homes, and we were all now for the first time in our lives having trouble paying for them. It was a dark period. I still didn't know that much about the business, how it worked, and how deep and high up the chains of command went. I'd never been on the wrong side of the record label before, or imagined that Motley Crue would be caught between the cogs of a machine that wanted to crush it. At the same time, I was losing my grip on what Motley represented. I was so angry at my father and my ex-wife and my record label that my dark, demented side took over. For the Swine Show, Tommy had found some bootleg footage of people committing suicide and getting burned to death. It was gruesome stuff, and the idea was to screen these atrocities during our anti-suicide song, Flush, to show the audience that, no matter how miserable they were, they still had it pretty good. But when I looked out at the audience during the song, they all looked terrified. I remembered too late that kids don't go to a Motley Crue concert to think about their own mortality. They go to a Motley Crue concert to hopefully get a blowjob in the backseat of a car. And then, when our morale couldn't have been any lower and our relationship with Electra couldn't have gotten any worse, Vince decided to quit the band again.
Chapter 7. Vince. The curious tale of the coxcomb who quit quitting only to quit again. I was fed up with Tommy, who had been a dick to me ever since I rejoined the band, and I was fed up with these stupid rules. All of a sudden, we went from the world's most decadent, party-mad band to the world's strictest, most sober band. We tried to be sober on the feel-good tour, and it didn't work then, so I didn't see any reason why it was going to work now. I like to have a cocktail every now and then, and I don't like them to cost $25,000 each. A buddy of mine owned a big Gulfstream jet and was nice enough to fly us to our show in San Francisco. Afterward, he was going to take us to our next stop, Boise, Idaho. We were getting close to the end of the West Coast leg of the tour, and I was thinking of quitting, because I had a lot more fun on my own than playing a set that consisted almost completely of new electronica grunge songs with the Sobo Police and Tommy Anderson Lee. I didn't rejoin the band to be miserable. That's not what Kovac had promised when he begged and pleaded and wheedled. So after the show, I had a drink, went to a strip club, and took a taxi home. Evidently, Nikki ended up in the exact same taxi the next day, heard from the driver I'd been drinking, and called my room demanding $25,000. I told him that I wasn't going to give him money every time he opened his mouth. Next thing I knew, a guy with a piss test was knocking on my hotel room door. I told him to fuck off or I'd kick his ass. The band was meeting in the lobby at 4 p.m. that afternoon to head to Boise. So I went downstairs and told Tommy and Mick that I was sick of this bullshit and planning to bail out at the end of the West Coast tour. Nicky was standing with Donna and his grandfather by the front desk, so I walked over to break the news to him. "I quit," I said. "I can't fucking do this shit anymore." Nicky wheeled around and said, "Why, because you can't be honest?" He made me change my mind. Instead of quitting during the tour break, I was going to quit right then. "Fuck you, I'm out of here," I snapped. "It's been fun getting to know you again. Have a nice trip home." He handed his jacket to his wife, gave his bag to his grandfather, turned to me and said calmly, "Hey, Vince, if you're going to leave, why don't you take this on your trip?" Then he nailed me in the jaw with an uppercut. I couldn't believe it. This was a reaction I expected from Tommy, not Nicky. I think he had built up a lot of anger over the course of the tour between his feud with Sylvia Roan, the father issues he was trying to work out on stage, and the $10 million lawsuit from his ex. In that moment, he took it all out on me. He threw me down on the ground in an adrenaline rage, grabbed my neck and dug his fingernails in, screaming that he was going to rip out my vocal cords while our tour manager, Nick Kua, looked on in horror. I'm a bigger guy than Nick and in much better shape, so I socked him square in the face and threw him off. I walked out of the revolving doors and went to my pilot friend's hotel a couple blocks away. "Let's go back to L.A., I told him. We took a cab to the airport and found the whole band in the waiting area, assuming that somehow everything was okay, that we had gotten the anger out of our system, and we were going to press on to Boise. The pilot and I walked past them. Nicky, Mick, and Tommy picked up their bags to follow. "Wait right here," I told them. Then I boarded the plane, shut the door, sat down next to the window, and flipped them off. It was my greatest performance on the whole tour. Predictably, Nick Kua came knocking on the door. I let him in. "Is there any way we can work this out?" he asked. "No," I told him. "Go do whatever you want to do. Go to Boise, go back to L.A. I don't care. I'm going home." Within an hour, I was at the Peninsula Hotel having drinks. Then I went home, grabbed Heidi, threw her onto the bed, fucked her good, and went to sleep with the satisfaction of knowing that the band was still at the airport. The guys were stuck there for 8 hours waiting for a commercial flight. They ended up canceling the sold-out show in Boise and returning to L.A. Jordan Berliant at our management office kept calling me at home with Nicky on the line, but I refused to speak to him. Finally, after a day or two of enjoying the freedom of doing whatever the fuck I wanted, I agreed to one of the meetings our managers seemed to like so much. We sat down in two swivel chairs in their offices, facing each other like preteen siblings forced by their parents to kiss and make up. Since Tommy and Nicky had kicked me out of the band on that rainy night 6 years ago, we had never really talked about our problems. We just swept them under the carpet and ignored them, hoping they'd go away. But eventually the carpet became too lumpy with all that dirt, and we kept tripping over it whenever we tried to walk. As we sat there, I finally had the chance to say the things to him that had been building up for those 6 years. "Your problem is that you're really condescending to people," I told him. "You talk down to people like they aren't up to your level." "I guess I can be like that." "You can be such a snot to the guys in the band. Not just me. You treat Tommy like a baby, and you pretend like Mick doesn't even exist. You run this band like a fucking dictator, and everything always has to be done your way. But sometimes you don't know everything. You were the one who made us look stupid in Rolling Stone because you didn't know who Gary Hart was. It would help if you listened to other people." For an hour, we sat there and ragged on each other. "Then I want you to cut the bullshit," he told me. "I can deal with the drinking. Maybe we can even stop the piss tests. But I don't want you telling me you're not going to drink, then moving the goalposts and going out drinking. I don't want you lying to me and getting angry at me every time we talk about it. We're out there covering your debts, and I don't mind that. But then, when we're getting in these stupid jive contests every night because you're trying to hide stuff from us, it makes us resent you. Your lying is a lot worse for the health of this band than the drinking." "I'll tell you what, then. I can promise you that I will never drink before a show or let it interfere with band business. But when I'm on my own time, you have to let me do whatever the fuck I want and not have some guy knocking on my door at 9 a.m. with a urine jar. If you stop acting like a cop all the time, I'll stop feeling like a prisoner and start being honest about it." "Okay," he said. "And I'll try to listen more and not be so condescending." because I don't always know what's right for everybody. We'd be a better band anyway if we listened to each other. I'm sorry, I've been going through a lot lately. That's why we should be getting along and sticking together, because the truth is that you're all I have. You know me better than anyone in the world. Through 6 albums and countless tours, Nicky and I had always been so different. I was the laid-back beach bum who loved golfing and racing. He was the unhealthy, secluded rocker who loved drugs and underground music. I liked to wear shorts and flip-flops. He was always in black leather and boots. But after that conversation, Nicky and I became best friends. We were inseparable. We finally came to truly like and understand one another after 17 years, and since then we've always been able to keep each other in check. That fight was the best thing that ever happened to us. The next day, we rescheduled the show in Boise, flew there in my very confused friend's Gulfstream jet, and played the best set of the whole tour. After we wrapped up our last show, I gave the band the best present I could. I checked myself into rehab in Malibu and quit drinking.
Chapter 8. Tommy. On how the world's most failed love was reduced overnight to the world's most famous broken fingernail. I'm gonna stack everything up for you, dude. Ever since Vince had returned to the band, I was unhappy with the direction we were going in, which was backward, and losing the support of our record label only made the situation more miserable. I have so much passion for music, dude, but when I went on stage, I just didn't feel it anymore. For the first time in my life, I wasn't excited about what we were doing. I was trapped by what we were doing. And a drummer who feels like his hands are tied is no fucking good. Then I just had my second child, and fatherhood doesn't exactly come with a fucking instruction manual. I read some shit and tried to dive in and learn, but Pamela kept saying everything I did was wrong. I used to be at the top of the charts with Pamela. When Brandon was born, I dropped to number 2 because at that age, of course, a child needs his mom all the time. So I walked around like the invisible man. I'd say, "Hey baby, what's up? I love you." And she'd just nod, not paying attention. I'd ask her to come down to the garage and listen to some new music I was working on. She'd promise to be there in a minute, and then she'd completely forget. I couldn't even have a conversation with her because she had her panties in a wad about the baby all the time. Then, when Dylan was born, I dropped down to number 3. Now I was full-on non-existent, and I couldn't deal with that. I'm a guy who loves to give love and loves to get love back. But at home, all I was doing was giving. I wasn't getting Jack back. Then, Pamela flew her parents down from Canada to help with the boys. It was great for the kids to have Grandma around, but the in-laws were at the house every fucking day at all hours, taking up more of Pamela's time. So, unable to step back and see the situation from any reasonable perspective, I turned into a whiny, needy little brat. Maybe it was my way of becoming Pamela's third child, so I'd get the attention I needed to. Now, all of a sudden, Pamela and I were arguing all the time. Our relationship had slowly degenerated from pure love to love-hate. If my head had been clearer, I would have given her a break and fucking loved myself instead of looking to other people for affirmation. But old habits are hard to break. I'd spent my whole life looking for myself and other people, looking for them to tell me who I was. And once I let them define me, I became completely dependent on them, because without them, I didn't exist. On Valentine's Day, when we should have been all about fucking love, we went to the Hard Rock Casino in Las Vegas. I asked a florist to fill the room with rose petals, ordered a bottle of Dom Perignon, and set the perfect mood for our first night alone in months. But after a few glasses of champagne, Pamela became so worried about being away from the kids that she couldn't even enjoy herself. All she could talk about was breastfeeding Dylan, and all I could think about was that it was my turn to be breastfed. The next day we went to see the Rolling Stones play downstairs, and it was all bad. She saw a stripper talking to me after the concert, and we got in a huge-ass blowout in the middle of the casino. I grabbed her to take her into the room so the fucking gossip columns wouldn't be filled with news of us fighting in public, and she went ballistic. Our anger kept escalating until she finally ran out of the hotel, took the car, and drove back to Malibu alone. Valentine's Day was a fucking wash. I had to crawl back to the house on my hands and knees begging for mercy. The week afterward, I was in the kitchen cooking dinner for Pamela and the kids. Everything was quiet and cool again, and we were splitting a glass of wine as I pulled a bunch of vegetables to stir-fry out of the refrigerator. I looked through the cabinets for a pan and couldn't find one because the fucking housekeeper had our cooking shit scattered all over the place. I was so high-strung and tense that as soon as the littlest thing went wrong, I'd start to freak out like it was the end of the world. So when I couldn't find the pan, I started slamming cabinet doors and throwing shit around like a little baby crying for attention, hoping Mommy would come and solve all his problems. So Mommy, Pamela, came over, saw that I was in one of those moods, and just threw up her hands. "Calm down, it's just a pan." But it wasn't just a pan. It meant everything to me. My whole fucking peace of mind and sanity depended on me finding that pan. And by not caring whether I found the pan or not, Pamela, in my mind, was disrespecting my feelings. In my fucked up, selfish way of thinking, it meant that Pamela didn't understand me. The worst sin someone can commit in a relationship. I grabbed all the pots and mixing bowls I had pulled out, fucking threw them in the big open drawer I had taken them from, and screamed, "This is bullshit!" And then Pamela said the words that you should never say to anyone who's losing their temper. The words that only pour gasoline on the blaze. "Calm down. You're scaring me." I should have walked outside and just vented at the stars, or gone for a long jog, or taken a cold shower. But I didn't. I was too wrapped up in the moment, in my anger at the missing pan, which was really my anger at the miscommunication between Pamela and me, which all boiled down to nothing but my own insecurity, neediness, and fear. "Fuck you! Fuck off! Leave me the fuck alone!" I yelled at her, kicking the drawer and hurting my fucking foot like an idiot because I had forgotten I was wearing soft slippers. That was it. We were off and running. She screamed at me. I screamed back at her, and pretty soon the kids started screaming. Dylan was crying in his crib, and I could hear Brandon in his bedroom bawling, "Where? Mommy, Daddy, what's going on? Where?" "I've had enough," Pamela said as she ran to the crib and scooped up Dylan. She brought him into the living room, grabbed the phone, and started to dial. "Who do you think you're calling?" "I want my mom to come over. You're scaring me." "Don't call your mom. Put the fucking phone down. We can deal with this ourselves." "No, don't try to stop me. And don't swear in front of the kids. I'm calling them. Your parents are here all the fucking time. This is so stupid. We can talk about this and be over it in 1 minute. Look at me. I'm calm now. I'm not mad anymore. I'm calling Mom. And stop swearing." She dialed the numbers, and I hung up the phone. Then she turned and fixed me with that dirty look, the one that told me that I was mean and selfish, the one that reduced me to the ugliest, scrawniest worm on the face of the fucking planet. I fucking hated that look, because it meant that the situation was escalating out of my control, and no amount of apologies or flowers would ever convince her that I was a good guy who loved her again. Her therapist had given her the stupid advice of ignoring me when I was angry, because, according to him, I received enough attention as a rock star. But what he didn't know was that I was a rock star because I needed the attention. Silence equals death. So, when Pamela started giving me the silent treatment, just like my parents used to, it only drove me further over the brink. In the meantime, Dylan was yelling in her arms, and Brandon was howling louder and louder from his room. She defiantly grabbed the phone again and dialed her parents. I slammed down the hang-up bar. I said, "Don't fucking call her. Come on. I'm sorry. This is so fucking petty." She threw the phone against the handset, clenched her fist, and swung at me blindly, connecting half her fist with my lower jaw and the other half with the tender part of my neck, which fucking hurt. I had never been hit by a woman before, and as soon as I felt the contact, I saw red. I'd been trying so hard to defuse the situation, but when she kept getting madder at every turn, it only incensed me more. The more willing I was to calm down, the madder I became when she wouldn't let me. So as soon as she slugged me, my emotional meter flew into the red and clouded my eyes. Like an animal, I did the first thing that instinctually came to mind to stop the situation. I grabbed her and held her firmly. "What is fucking wrong with you?" I yelled, not letting go. And once again, my attempt to calm her only panicked her more. Now she was crying, the kids were freaking out, and the phone was ringing off the hook because her parents were worried because of all the cut-off phone calls. My stir-fry had turned into a nightmare. As I held her, the silent treatment ended. She yelled every shitty thing she could think of at me, called me every dirty name in the book, stabbed at every one of my weak points. I never could have imagined when we stared at each other all night at Senor Frog's that it would end up like this, with us crying and screaming at each other like demons. I released her, and she began to run toward Brandon's bedroom as if she was the loving mother who needed to protect her brood from their cruel father. As she ran past, I swung my foot after her and helped her on her way with a swift, slippered boot to her ass. "You are a fucking bitch! You're mean!" I followed her. I hated fighting in front of the kids. It was hard enough trying to raise them with paparazzi everywhere. The least we could do is set a healthy example as parents. I sulked toward Brandon's room to talk to him, but she had picked him up and was shielding him as he cried. "Let go of him," I said. "I'm going to take him outside. Do you want to go see the frogs, Brandon?" Our backyard pond had suddenly filled with frogs over the winter, and I thought it would be a good place to breathe deep and chill out. "Get out of here," she screamed hysterically. "Listen," I said. "I'm going to take him out to the frogs so that he can calm down. You stay with Dylan so you two can calm down. Everyone just needs to stop screaming." But everyone kept screaming, except Pamela, who wasn't speaking to me again, which made it impossible to resolve anything. I took Brandon's hand, and she pulled him away from me. Suddenly, we were wrestling over him, and everyone was getting mental again. No matter what I did, the situation just escalated. As I wrestled Brandon from her, I pushed her, and she tumbled backward into a little blackboard covered with chalk drawings our kids had made. She tried to catch herself on the blackboard with her hands, but the face of the board swiveled forward, and she broke her nail. Before she could finish yelling, I had taken Brandon by the hand and walked outside with him. I took him to the frog pond and sat him down. As he sniffled, I told him that Mommy and Daddy loved each other very much, and we loved him very much. I promised that we would never get angry and raise our voices again if it scared him. I picked up a mellow little frog and cupped him in my hands. As my hands closed around him, he started struggling and flailing. "That's how Daddy feels sometimes. That's why it's good to go outside, breathe the fresh air, and clear your head." After we both calmed down and dried our tears, we headed back inside. I tried to find Pamela to apologize and suggest ordering some dinner. I searched every room downstairs and couldn't find her. I brought Brandon to his playroom, and as I sat him down with his toys, I heard voices behind me. I turned around to see two cops standing there. "Turn back around, Mr. Lee," they barked at me. "For what?" "Turn around." It was like the Bobby Brown incident all over again. Here were two cops who were going to arrest me no matter what I said. If it takes two people to get into an argument, why am I always the one getting arrested? I turned around and felt cold metal wrap around my hands, followed by two clicks. "You're handcuffing me? Are you fucking kidding me? Handcuff her too. She hit me in the face." "We don't care, Mr. Lee."
"But..."
They led me downstairs, past the living room where I saw Pamela sitting with her parents, out the front door, and into the back of the squad car. Then they left me there alone while they went back inside to question Pamela. I relaxed when I realized that they were probably just separating us so they could question us in private. I probably wasn't going to be taken to jail. An hour later, the officers stepped out of the house. One of the cops was carrying a Civil War-era pistol that I had on the wall as decoration, and when I saw it, my heart sank. I knew they were going to somehow twist the antique into a firearm possession charge, which violated a probation sentence I had picked up 4 years ago, after I packed a semi-automatic pistol in my travel bag and stupidly carried it through an airport metal detector. Wordlessly, the cops climbed into the car and backed out of the driveway.
"Hey, where are you going?"
I asked, panicked.
"You're going downtown."
Again, I felt a situation that should have been easy to deal with spiraling out of my control into something that was going to be a real pain in the ass.
"Dude, you guys didn't even talk to me yet. You were only listening to her side of the story. What about my side?"
They didn't say a word. They just ignored me and kept driving. And bro, I just fucking rammed my head into the wire mesh separating the front of the car from the back seat. I kept bashing it against the wire helplessly, yelling,
"Why won't you fucking listen to me? Fucking talk to me!"
I had turned into a child again because I was being given the silent treatment. And silence equals death.
Chapter 9. Nikki. of the rueful conversation which passed between Nikki Six, a Freeman, and Tommy Lee, a dog's body, concerning the tale of the rug burns on Pamela Anderson Lee's back. Tommy used to call from jail in tears every day. Separated from his kids and wife, he was in agony. As angry as he was at Pamela for pressing spousal assault charges and sticking him with a 6-month sentence, he still wanted her back so badly. But she kept toying with him, driving him out of his mind. He would pour out his heart in letters to her every day, none of which he'd ever show us. The worst part for the band was losing Tommy at such a critical juncture in our dispute with Elektra. In addition, Vince was having major money problems, and we had scheduled a tour independent of the label to bail him out. Because if he couldn't get together a lump sum for his creditors, they were going to foreclose on his, and thus our, assets. If Tommy stayed in jail for a full 6 months, however, the tour would be canceled at our expense. Vince would be destitute, and Elektra would have us vulnerable and right where it wanted us. As much as any of us, Tommy needed this tour because the money would help him pay his legal bills and support his children. But Tommy's mind was so far removed from such matters. All he could think about was trying to get back to the domestic bliss that was life with Pamela Anderson, even though she had already started divorce proceedings and hadn't visited him once. As far as Tommy was concerned, however, Motley Crue was over, a closed chapter. Every girl does the same thing to a young band. They always say, "You're the most popular," or "You're the cutest one," or "You're the one everyone talks about." With older, more experienced bands, the women have to get more subtle. They say, "Those guys are holding you back," or "You should be getting more money," or "They're not treating you with enough respect." And every time the guy will say, "Really? Do you think so?" They don't have the balls to say, "Shut the fuck up. We are a fucking gang, and we've been a gang since the beginning. So please stay out of it." This happens because every girl wants her guy to be the guy. And every guy wants to hear from a girl that he is the guy. And so what happens afterward is that when one guy driving the band says left, the henpecked guy will say, "No, let's go right." He won't really want to go right, but he'll want to assert himself as the leader. Every band is the same. The drugs, the women, the ego. All three of them prey on you and destroy your group. And, after getting over the drugs, the women and the egos were destroying us. "I don't know if I can do this anymore," Tommy said. "Why would I want to tour just to pay for Vince's mistakes?" The touring was about more than Vince and his pocketbook. It was also about getting Tommy out of jail. We had every promoter in the country writing the judge letters about the financial straits they'd be in if Tommy's jail term forced the cancellation of dates. So I told Tommy, like I had a million times before, that he could do both, start his own band and play in Motley Crue. That's what I was doing with my side project, 58, a collaboration with David Darling, who happened to be married to Bree Howard, which made him my ex-stepfather-in-law. "I'll tell you one thing," I said. "Being on the road with Motley Crue is going to be a hell of a lot safer than being at home with Pamela Anderson." As I visited Tommy in jail each week, I wondered why I had never done the same for Vince when he was serving time after the Razzle accident. He was my brother and bandmate too, but back then I was too addicted and self-indulgent to think about anyone else. I called Vince and said, "You know what sucks? That I've been to visit Tommy a dozen times in jail, and I never went to visit you once." "It's okay," Vince said. "You were really fucked up back then." "It's not okay with me," I said. "It was a miserable time for you, and we weren't there for you. We had just completed the most successful tour a young rock band had ever gone out on. We had just enjoyed the best times of our lives together. And when you went to jail, we dropped you like a hot sack of shit." "Don't worry about it," Vince said. "Everything ended up okay." "I don't know if it did," I said. "I don't know if it did." That night, Vince and I decided to spend some time together. There was a party at the Playboy Mansion, and we pulled in after midnight. When we walked in, a friend named Dennis Brody ran up to us. He said Pam had just been at the party getting very friendly with her ex-boyfriend, a surfer named Kelly Slater, in the middle of the game room with dozens of people watching. The next afternoon, Tommy called. He was excited because he had just checked his answering machine and there was a message from Pam. He made me call his machine and listen to it. "I love you so much, baby," the message began, "and I'm so sorry you were in there. I know it will make you a stronger person, though. Just always remember that I love you and care about you very much." I called Tommy back. "Dude," he said, "I have hope. There's a good chance now that we will be back together." I wanted to keep my mouth shut, but that's not what a real friend would do. "I have a story to tell you," I began, "and I don't think you're going to like it." He was flabbergasted. He refused to believe that while he was in jail talking to cockroaches, she was out getting the cockroach. "You know what?" he told me. "Pam always hated you." I always knew that was true. Some people said it was because she was jealous of my friendship with Tommy, but I always thought it was because she couldn't control me. Every time she went out to eat with us, she had every man at the table willing to sell their soul to pay the check, or pass the bread, or pick up a napkin she had dropped. But I was never interested. I used to tell Mick that I wouldn't even fuck her with his dick. She just seemed weird and misshapen, like someone had beat her face in with an ugly stick, albeit a very expensive ugly stick. Who she reminded me of, actually, was some of the chicks Vince fucked. And come to think of it, she was one of the chicks Vince fucked.
Chapter 10. Tommy. Fragments from the Lost Writings of Thomas Bace Lee, composed under duress in the period of his incarceration in the year of our Lord, 1998. 5-28-98. F-E-A-R. False evidence that appears real. Fear, the enemy of faith. Where faith is, fear isn't. I shall fear not. Why am I scared? Is she going to leave me? Will she come back? Does she really love me? If it's in fact, rap. Fear can make a person see something that's not there, or hear something that was not said. My cell is a one-man submarine. Worry is soul suicide. If in fact, she really, really loves me, then why did she leave me? And will she ever come back? Possible album title, Fear Drops from 5-29-98. Control your emotion, or it will control you. The angry man will defeat himself in battle, as well as in life. 5-31-98, written on the back of a pamphlet titled Our Daily Bread. Pamela. I'm sorry to hear that you're taking the incident that we had as the breakpoint of our marriage. It was a terrible incident. I'm being punished for it. They got us. The press, the stress, the public, etc. We let them destroy us. 6-1-98. To P. Lee. Could we dig up this treasure? Were it worth the pleasure? Where we wrote love's songs? God, we have parted way too long. Could the passionate past that has fled call back its dead? Could we live it all over again? Were it worth the pain? I remember we used to meet by a swing seat over the piano, and you chirped each pretty word with the air of a bird. And your eyes, they were blue, green, and gray, like an April day, but lit into amethyst when I stooped and kissed. I remember I could never catch you, for no one could match you. You had wonderful luminous fleet, little wings on your feet. I remember so well the hotel room, fun in the sun in Cancun, that beat that played in the living room and La Boom in the warm February sun. Could we live it over again? Were it worth this pain? Could the passion past that has fled call it back, or is it dead? Well, if my heart must break, dear love, for your sake, it will break in music, I know. Poets' hearts break so. But strange that I was not told that the heart can hold in its tiny prison cell God's heaven and hell. Undated letter to Jay Leno. Jay, Pamela asked you not to go there, and you did. Pam said she talked to you after the show and told you she was upset. And she told me you said to her, don't worry. This will be good for her career. Is there anything you'd like to say to me about this? I consider what might have been called our friendship to be seriously damaged. Tommy Lee. P.S. The stand-up guy I thought you were might go back on the air and apologize for having given me a long-distance sucker punch. I'm not suggesting that you take my side publicly. I don't need anyone to do that. Without knowing all the facts, my private life should not have been grist for the mill of your program. 6-2-98. Pamela, please take Brandon aside and read this to him, okay? Thank you. Brandon, Daddy is at work playing the drums and wishes he could be with you on this special day. Daddy is always with you in spirit today and every day. You may be too young to understand, but I plant the seeds. You are perfect just as you are. Love is all there is, and now is all we have. So enjoy today. Happy birthday, lover boy. I miss you. Daddy. P.S. Pamela. Please squeeze him really, really, really tight for me from Daddy, okay? You can't even imagine what this is like for me to miss this. 6-25-98. My cell. This tiny room sounds so still. It smells like stale sulfur in the water. It seeps through the walls. It tastes like death. The floor has a sticky slime that is detriment to body and soul. I spin, not in circles, but in squares, from the shape of this room. 6-26-98. So there was a little geisha girl, ho, from Tokyo. She said she could blow, so I said, let's go. Yo, jump in my limo. Back to the no-tell motel for a little kiss and tell. Damn, my dick's starting to swell. So I gave her two glasses of panty remover, hoping to subdue her so I could screw her. I had no clue the bitch knew kung fu. Then my rubber blew. Oh, my God, what's this green goo? Now I might have AIDS. At least I got laid. Wasn't worth what I paid for this pussy. Should I be afraid? Nah. Just spray your dick with some Raid. Shit, I'm going crazy. What the fuck am I writing? I hope no one sees this. 7-28-98. Hi, baby. Here I sit in a cage on the rooftop with, for the first time in weeks, sunshine on my face. They only let me up here at 4 p.m., and I just caught what's left of the sun. Wow. Squinting from the rays that I'm not used to. I cried as sadness and pain remind me of why I'm here constantly, like a permanent scar. I hate it here, and I'm never coming back. God, I miss the sunshine. I heard you ask me what my fantasy was on the phone the other day, and I hesitated to say it because I didn't want to create any pressure about it. But I'd love to share it with you, and a letter is safer than a phone call. That way you can know what I'm feeling without feeling the pressure of having to say something. My fantasy is that when I'm released from jail that I could see you and spend some time alone together, or perhaps find some time alone together. We have so many things to talk about. I would love to share with you how my life is going to be in so many ways different. When I look ahead into the future, I see a lot of happiness for Tommy. I'd also love to share all the new things I've learned with you. I miss your sparkling eyes. Also, I miss your phone calls and that smile that makes me weak. 7-31-98. Pamela, please don't send me your meaningless letters. How can you write that shit after fucking someone else? The president can admit his infidelity, but you can't. I don't trust you. Please leave me alone. You have no idea what love is or passion. My love is powerful. If yours was, you would have been able to stay home and be a mother and kept your panties on. You're right. You do need to keep your distance from me. I don't want to look at you.
I'll throw up. You took my dream from me. My family. I will not let you kill my dream. I will one day find someone special who truly loves me. And you're right. There will never be another man like me. You make all this sound like I forced you into this. I think you're trying to make yourself feel better about yourself and the infidelity and choosing another man. This is all your choice, not mine. Can you say guilty? It will eat you alive. You have nothing at all to fear, and certainly the boys don't. I will not pursue you. I will answer your letter later. You've made the biggest mistake of your and the children's life. P.S. Hope you weren't wearing the cross I got you while you were getting fucked. 8798. I've got 4 weeks left in here, and I need to get my head straight. Can you talk to me about this? I deserve to know. I need truth and clarity. I gotta make some decisions. Every human thought and every human action is based in either love or fear. Which one are you basing your decision on? 8-16-98. Soft, tender, nurturing. Who am I? A father of two boys. A creative and talented soul with a passion for music and a love of life and nature, the ocean and its creatures. Sunsets are my fave time of day. I've always loved children. I've also loved sex, movies, music, fast cars, drawing, painting, water skiing, fishing, dirt bikes, boating, camping. An addictive personality would be accurate. I can be manipulating too, only in fear of losing her. Who did I marry? Pamela is sexy, sensitive, shy, nurturing, loving, passionate, sometimes crazy and scattered. She's a caretaker. She's also controlling, sheltered, closed. She needs lots of attention. She needs to live. Go outside in nature and enjoy. I can't remember the last time we walked together. I would ask a lot, but no response. Don't blame yourself, Tommy. 8-16-98. Oh, God. I just heard Pamela's voice on the phone. I'm trembling with tears. I miss her so much. Back to the walking thing, we were trapped a lot. Prisoners of our own celebrity. Nobody understands what it's like to be trapped in jail without my family. The pain is unbearable. Christy spent hours with Pam last night and didn't really have any info for me. Bummer. I could really use some in here. The day before, I spent 2 hours on the phone with Christy. She had to mention me. The silence is killing me. I feel like my childhood is here. Silence. 9-1-98. I will be there for you no matter what. When I get out, karate, steak, bath, Hawaii. When I get out of here, there are some things I desire to do. Eat a steak, take a long look at the sunset at the beach. A long bath with lots of bubbles. With you would be awesome, too. That, too, with you wouldn't suck. Some karate lessons and boxing again. Also, Hawaii for 7 days. Pam, I want you to know that I will always be there for you. Even if things don't work out for us. No matter what. Okay? 9-4-98. Written on a post-it note. Love. Stay centered. Strength. Chapter 11. Tommy. Of the humbling of Thomas Lee, and the end of this protracted adventure. I'll never forget that bus ride from the courtroom, chained to the fucking seat. Still in the suit I'd been wearing in front of the judge only 15 minutes before. As they marched me into the jail, the first thing I heard was a loud cracking noise. I turned my head to see a little Latin dude lying on the floor of his cell with blood pouring out of his skull. I looked at the officers who were leading me to my cell and asked, "Isn't anyone going to help that guy?" "Oh, that happens all the time," they said nonchalantly. "He's just having a seizure." I looked back at him and he was just lying there on the ground, not even moving. They brought me into a nearby room and undressed me.
I stood there scared shitless and butt naked except for the rings in my nipples, my nose, and my eyebrow. An officer ran to get wire cutters. He clipped my nipple rings and my nose ring, but he couldn't get my earrings off because they're surgical steel. He begrudgingly let me keep them on. Then he handed me my jail gear. Blue shirt, black shoes, and a bedroll with a towel. Plastic comb, toothbrush, and toothpaste. The officers led me back into the corridor, and I noticed that after half an hour, they were finally taking the Latino prisoner to the infirmary. It looked more like a fucking stroke than a seizure. As they led me past the other prisoners, I saw rows of gnarly motherfuckers yelling shit like, "Welcome, man," and "I'll teach you how to treat a lady." Half were excited. The other half wanted to kick my ass for fucking with a chick they probably whacked off to every night. The walk seemed like a mile, and I was so scared my knees buckled and the cops practically had to drag me. They threw me in an isolated cell and shut the heavy door, which sent a loud metallic thud reverberating through the cell block. It was the loneliest fucking sound I'd ever heard. This was the room I was supposed to spend the next 6 months in. It was basically a rock of concrete broken up only by a metal bed with a useless half-inch mattress. I had no one to talk to, nothing to write with, and dick shit to do. Whenever guards walked by, I would ask them for a pencil, and they would ignore me. They were trying to let me know that I wouldn't get any special treatment from them. The spoiled little brat in me was about to be taught a lesson, because if he didn't grow into a man in this place, he never would. That evening, a big, no-necked guard woke me up, banging on the door. "Get over here," he barked. I walked to the door, unsure whether I was about to receive a favor or a punishment. "What the fuck do you got earrings in for?" he asked.
"They left them there. They couldn't get them out."
"What are you then? Some kind of fucking faggot?" I was prepared for the worst. A beating, a fucking, whatever.
"Oh, dude, why are you hassling me?"
"No, I think you're a faggot. And do you know what we do with faggots in here?" I went back to my bed and ignored him. I didn't know what to do. The fucker could have opened my cell door, clubbed me senseless, and in the morning no one would have cared.
After 6 or 7 days of just sitting there going crazy, with the knowledge that I had 5 months and 3 weeks of this shit left, a half-sized pencil came rolling under my door. A day later, a Bible materialized under the door. Then little religious pamphlets called Our Daily Bread started appearing every few days. I'd lie around with the Bible and pencil reading Our Daily Bread and thanking whoever had given me these priceless gifts because I needed something to get my mind off the boredom and the torture. I must have replayed every moment of my relationship with Pamela in my head 1,000 times. I couldn't understand why Pamela had followed through with pressing charges. She was probably scared and thought I was some crazy, violent monster. She probably thought she was doing the right thing for the kids. And she probably wanted an easy way out of a difficult situation. As much as I loved Pamela, she had a problem dealing with things. If something wasn't right in her life, she'd rather get rid of it than take the time to work on it or fix it. She fired managers like I changed socks. Personal assistants and nannies would blow through our house like pages of a calendar. Every day there was a new one, which always pissed me off because I wanted the kids to have someone consistent in their lives, who they could trust and who would grow to love them almost as much as we did. So, the way I understood it, what Pamela did to me was basically fire me. I was fucking fired. I needed to stop torturing myself and get some fucking good out of the experience. So I came to the conclusion that my mission was introspection. I needed to search inside myself and find the answers I was looking for. And the best way to do that was to stop finding faults with Pamela and other people and start finding the faults that lay within myself. At first, I just started writing on the walls. Most of what I wrote began with the word, why. Why am I here? Why am I unhappy? Why would I treat my wife like this? Why would I do this to my kids? Why don't I have any spirituality? Why? 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 After a few weeks, a guard asked me if I'd like to go up to the roof. "Dude, I would love that," I told him. I could hardly remember what air smelled like, what the sky looked like, what the sun felt like on my face. I couldn't wait to stand on this rad jail rooftop and take in the mountains and the city again. They chained me, brought me to the roof, and my jaw dropped open, bro. The walls around the roof were so high that it was just like being in another cell. There were no trees, mountains, oceans, or buildings in sight. They stuck me in a cage up there called a K-10, which is something the judge had ordered so that I'd be protected from the other inmates. It was about 4 p.m., and the sun was starting to sink out of view behind the wall. Its last beams were hitting the top corner of the cage. I pressed myself against the front of the cage and stood on my tiptoes so I could feel the sun on my face. As soon as its warmth spread over my forehead, nose, and cheeks, I burst into tears. I closed my eyes and cried as I bathed in the last 10 minutes of sunlight left on that roof. The last 10 minutes of sunlight I'd see for days, weeks, or months. Dude, I had taken the fucking sun for granted all my life. But stick me in a dark, cold cell for a few weeks, and it was the greatest thing anyone could ever fucking give me. It felt like the most beautiful day of my life. When I lost my little piece of sun, I pulled myself up on the dip bar they had in the cage and exercised. Before going to jail when I was free on a fucking $500,000 bail, I had worked out for a month straight to prepare for the worst. Outside the cage, the general population was playing in the yard, and I was a sitting target for all kinds of abuse. Huge gangbangers would throw shit at me and yell, "You're lucky you ain't with us, you motherfucking pussy! Hitting girls! Shit, come out and play with the big boys!" It was humiliating, but I just kept my head down and my mouth shut and thought about the sun. As time passed, I began to have more contact with the outside world. No one was allowed to send books to the jail, because people would mail novels with pages dipped in acid and shit. But through my lawyer, I was able to order 3 books every 10 days on Amazon. I fucking needed mind food. I picked up books on the 3 things I most wanted to improve: relationships, parenting, and spirituality. I put Tai Chi diagrams up on my walls, learned about pressure points underneath my eyes that release stress, and became an expert on self-help books and Buddhism. I was determined to give myself a full-blown psychological, physical, and musical tune-up. I wanted to fix the problems that were holding me back: myself, my relationship with Pamela, and my restlessness in Motley Crue. Though the judge had forbidden me to contact Pamela, there was nothing I wanted more than to speak to her and work things out. I was pissed at her, but I still felt trapped in a misunderstanding. A fucking missing stir-fry pan had ruined my life. They eventually installed a payphone in my cell, but it was a nightmare trying to reestablish contact with Pamela, who was still fuming over our fight. We began speaking through 3-way conversations with our lawyers and therapists, but every time the conversation quickly degenerated into a mudslinging fest and blame game. Eventually, a friend turned me on to an intermediary named Gerald, who was supposed to patch up all my relationships with Pamela, with my children, and with the band. I don't know anything about Gerald's credentials or training, but he had common sense. He told me that I had thrived on attention ever since I was a kid, doing things like opening up my window so that the neighbors could hear me play guitar. In some sick sense, as much as I loved Pamela, she was also the guitar that I wanted to show all the neighbors I knew how to play. Only, it turned out that I couldn't play it that well. When the lights dim and the disco biscuits are gone and you're sitting alone in a house with another person, only then does a relationship begin. And it will succeed if you can work through your problems and learn to enjoy the other person for who they really are, without all the pats on the back and thumbs up from your bros. Perhaps that's why celebrity relationships are so difficult. Everyone puts you both on such a high pedestal that it almost seems like a disappointment when, at the end of the day, you discover that you're just 2 human beings with the same emotional defects and mother-father issues as everybody else. The other way Gerald helped me was by ordering children's books for me through Amazon, then buying the same books for my boys. After I obtained permission from the court to talk to my kids, I would read them the stories over the phone while they looked at the pictures in the same book. It was important for me to keep that connection with my boys, because while I was in jail, Pamela was not only telling them that I was crazy, but also trying to turn my own mother and sister against me. It was impossible for me to defend myself, not just from Pamela, but from the media, who were making me out to be a monster. What hurt me most, though, was not being home for Father's Day and for Brandon's birthday. That's something a child doesn't forget. Every now and then,
I would call home and Pamela would answer the phone. We would start talking, but within minutes the old hostility, oversensitivity, and accusations would rise to the surface, and then suddenly, bang! One of us would hang up on the other. End of communication. I'd sit in my cell and cry for hours afterward. It was so frustrating not to be able to do anything about it. After a while, though, with my therapist on the phone as moderator, we learned to communicate again. I started responding to everything she said, not with insecurity and defensiveness, but with my own natural love, which was one good habit I had picked up as a child. I also learned that to be able to talk or even live with Pamela, I needed to stop testing her love for me. Because when you test someone and don't tell them, they're bound to fail. One Thursday, we were having a great conversation with my therapist and making a lot of progress, when I heard all this loud talking and banging outside the cell. I stood up and yelled, "Man, can you guys keep it down?" But as those words came out of my mouth, I realized it wasn't prisoners making the noise. It was that big no-neck motherfucker guard who had called me a faggot on my first night in jail. He stormed into my cell, grabbed the fucking phone cord, and ripped it out of the wall as I was talking. Then, he filed a report to the sergeant stating that I had been mouthing off to him. They suspended my phone privileges for 14 days. My lifeline to the outside world was fucking yanked, and I was in tears every day. During those long-ass weeks, I worked on songs for what I decided would be a solo project, read parenting magazines and self-help books, and learned to write poetry, mostly about Pamela. She had started sending letters to me, and it was so frustrating, because she would have her assistant address and mail the letters for her. It made them seem impersonal, like I was just a chore her assistant could take care of. I tried so hard not to think like that, not to judge every little action as a sign of whether she loved me or not, because that was how I got into trouble in the first place. Cut off from the telephone, I began to learn for the first time to be self-reliant, for love, for help, and for music. I also began to communicate with the other inmates and see that my problems were not so bad in comparison. The trustees who swept the hall began slipping me notes from guys in other cells. Sometimes a dude would be asking for an autograph. Others would just want to have a pen pal. Most of them were in for much more serious shit than me. There was a 16-year-old Mexican mafia dude who had fucking murdered 6 people. A really remorseful 21-year-old who had panicked and shot an old lady when he was robbing Norm's 24-hour restaurant for drug money. And a police officer who had gotten busted pocketing drugs during narcotics busts. He was so worried that the rest of the population would find out he was a cop, because they would kill him in a second if they knew. As I tapped into this internal mail system, I learned that there was a whole secret world in jail. And there were more fucking drugs in the system than on the street. People were offering fucking heroin, blow, speed, weed, everything in exchange for food, candy, money, and cigarettes. But the penalty if you were caught was a minimum of 1 year added to your sentence. So I wasn't fucking with